All right, so Andre and I are like tag teaming, but we haven't coordinated really, so this will be an interesting, I mean, too much. So I'm going to give you a brief review of why you might care about molecular gas and star formation in galaxies, and then talk about some results from a paper Andre and I had published earlier this year, where we model molecular gas in simulations of galaxies, hydro simulations of galaxies. And then Andre's gonna talk about some new stuff that he's been doing with Nick Nedden and Kostas Tassis, including H2 and cosmological simulations, and the metallicity dependence of the H2 abundance. So that should be interesting. I look forward to hearing it because I haven't heard about it. So this is the Schmidt-Kennicott relationship. It's a relationship between the star formation rate surface density and the gas surface density in galaxies. And what Kennicott did was he looked at individual disk galaxies, took an average over the disk of the amount of gas in the disk and the amount of star formation. And these are starburst galaxies, these are the centers of disks, and these are entire disks. And what he found was that there was a power law-like relationship between the two quantities, with the exponent being about 1.4. And this connects with work that Schmidt did in the 50s, where he looked at the luminosity function of stars in the Milky Way and found that he could reproduce the luminosity function of stars in the Milky Way if there was this kind of dependence between the volume star formation rate surface density and the gas surface density in a power law-like relationship.
What is volume surface density?
I'd say the volume star formation rate density and the volume gas density. Sorry, I just said the wrong thing. So anyway, so this has now taken a hold of the entire galaxy formation modeling community. It serves as the role of the vast majority of prescriptions that people use in their models of galaxy formation. So it's important for that reason alone. But this discussion really is going to concentrate, well, my part of the discussion, on these three points. So is the star formation efficiency the same in all galaxies? So is this relationship a global relationship, or does it vary from place to place in a galaxy, or does it vary between galaxies? Beyond that, how does this star formation why is the star formation efficiency important? How does it relate to outstanding problems in galaxy formation? And are there other ways of doing it? So, you know, I'm kind of giving it away, but it's you'll see that it's the case that this relationship is not a global relationship. And so what else can you do? How can you improve the realism of your models to capture kind of these deviations?
When people did make the estimates from observations,
yes,
of the surface gas density, what are they actually using? Using the neutral layer? Or?
So that's a very key point, actually. So this is done with the total gas. But you can do the molecular gas by itself, and they get different answers, and that's kind of the whole point of the talk.
H1 and then do a correction for?
No, you can actually measure. See, now Leo's not here, but you can actually measure the molecular gas.
You can't measure. Right, that's what you do.
Of course they measure some tracer, and then there's an X factor. And
okay, but they also measure the neutral amount.
Yes, I'll show you a picture in just a second. I'm sorry.
Well, that you can
do. So. Just as a key to the, or just as a lead-in, actually Kennicott noted that if you split this system, or the data into two parts, the starburst galaxies and local disks, really this relationship, the fit is dominated by the starburst. It's not dominated by kind of this cloud of points. And they have different power law-like relationships. So it's clear even from Kennicott's data that this does not have to be a global relationship over all surface densities. It depends on what you're talking about. So, right. So here.
That was not much evidence against the global relationship. A handful of points that might fit on the same line.
What do you mean? I mean, so if you ignore these points, you would not fit this line to this data. Right. That's, I mean, yeah.
And then once you know that those points are there, I mean, the center of that other blob thing is right on the line predicted by the other thing. I would say you have basically a single relation and a handful of outliers that enable you to draw something that deludes the observer into thinking that there's a different relation.
Well, it's true that the fit is dominated by these points, not by these points, because the error is, the scatter is bigger than these points.
Those points there predict the center of that relation, and there's a handful of points that don't agree with a straight line.
Well,
I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think that there's better evidence that I will give you that it's not a global relationship. Okay.
Well, what you'd really want.
Okay. Well, do you want to go straight there? Or do you...
two populations. That's what you'd really want to do.
Well, I mean, all he's saying is that, well, this one relationship predicts the center of the other, not the slope of the other, but the center of the other. So continuing on, if you have a power law-like relationship between the star formation rate surface density and the gas surface density, and you have an exponential gas disk, then it's pretty easy to see that the star formation will be more centrally concentrated if this power law n is above one. So this relationship here determines how centrally concentrated the star formation is in a disk. And the larger n that you have, the more centrally concentrated the star formation will be. And this influences the way that gas consumption proceeds in a disk. So let me just write down that the scale length of star formation in a disk goes like the gas scale length divided by n. Okay. So that's intuitive. Now you could also, let's try to glean something out of the Schmidt relationship. So the Schmidt relationship, you could write in a very general way as just that the volume rate of star formation is proportional to some normalization, equal to some normalization times the gas density divided by some time scale. It's just dimensional argument. So the star formation timescale is actually observed. People have observed or inferred from observations that the star formation timescale is equal to the star formation, the freefall timescale, which scales like the dynamical time, times some efficiency. And you might wonder, what sets this normalization? Well, that normalization could be set by something physical. In particular, it might be set by the fact that star formation should be related to the molecular gas. So if this sets the time scale, this sets how much of the gas is available for star formation. That's the molecular fraction, and it might depend on a variety of things. It could depend on the density, the metallicity, the temperature, the local interstellar radiation field strength. Bruce Emmelgreen showed that just through analytical calculations, it's related to the pressure and the volume emissivity of the interstellar radiation field. So this is something to keep in mind. But you can combine these things together to come up with a molecular Schmidt relationship, which I'll also write down. So
Brent, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you're taking this F to always be the fraction of the gas that's available to start making? I mean, you could also think of it as modifying the denominator in the top equation.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. No, I agree with you. Yeah. Okay. So there could be some other density dependence in the, but there, people like Mark Krumholtz and Tan and other people have shown that basically this relationship holds. So if you look at, you know, dense molecular clouds in the galaxy and you make an estimate of their star formation rate, basically a few percent of the gas is turned in, or the molecular gas is turned into stars on a free fall time scale. Okay, so there, it's true that this is degenerate with this, but you have to come up with some model, and this is one model that involves the molecular gas setting the amount of gas.
Typically, you have to keep it separate because TFF is defined for molecular gas. Right. So you have to apply it not to total gas density, but to only molecular gas density. So the assumption is that only molecular clouds with average densities above, say, 100, you form stars, and you don't form stars at lower densities.
But presumably, efficiency depends on the molecular gas density as well.
That's right, but the observational fact is that per free fall time, it's constant. It doesn't depend on density. It means that efficiency depends on density as inverse per density. Per free fall time, it's constant.
There's also another relationship. So now I realize scale height and scale length, I've used the same symbol for. But you can see that the mean density in a disk, whether it's the mean star formation rate density or the mean gas density, will be like the surface density divided by the scale height. So this gives you some estimate of what the density in the disk is. And then you can fold this into the Schmidt law to come up with something where I don't know what it's called, but I'm calling it today the composite Schmidt relationship, where you have some total amount of gas that's molecular, scaling like the gas density to the 1.5, and then these two factors for the gas scale height and the star formation rate scale height. So let me write that down as well, since I'll come back to it.
This is 1.5?
It's because sigma gas is, I mean, where it's 1.5 right. Sigma gas?
Yeah.
You assume that the...
It comes from the rho star from, it comes from the rho star formation rate being proportional to the gas to the 1.5. Okay. And then there's also this relationship, which Rosemary, I don't know if she's not here, was influential in developing, which is that the star formation rate surface density goes also like the gas surface density times the angular frequency in the disk. So these are kind of the standard, or, sorry.
I think it's important to point out that, you know, this is like very general. If there's a disk with a gaseous layer and a molecular layer, and you assume that locally there's a tight relation between star formation volume density and gas volume density of the kind that Schmidt advocated, and this follows, right? So this, if you go to surface densities, this is the relation you will get. And it immediately tells you that you only get something like Kennicott's relation, like, which is sigma star formation rate proportional to sigma gas to 1.4, 1.5.
If these are constant.
Other things are constant, right? And independent of sigma gas. So if you enter any regime where one of those factors become strongly dependent on surface density, you expect that the relation will be modified.
So part of the bottom to compare?
So we explain in our paper where we think this scaling comes from, but it turns out to be close to sigma gas to the 0.5 power.
Yes.
So, okay. So here's a picture of a galaxy. This is a very low mass galaxy, blue compact dwarf, NGC 2915. Here is the stellar component of the galaxy. The star formation has occurred only in the center here, but this is the large H1 disk. Now, this system would be very discrepant from the Kennicott relationship as plotted in the first plot. So this is already an indication that galaxies like this at least are deviant from the Kennicott relationship. It doesn't prove the point that I was making earlier that the gas surface density power might be different than 1.4 in some galaxies, but for that galaxy, it would not lie in the Schmidt-Kennicott relationship. If you look at M33, the observational facts as we were talking about yesterday, if you look at the relative distribution of molecular gas, the blue points here, which actually is data from Leo's work, and the H1 disk, which is Duhl and van der Holst, you can see the molecular gas is very much more centrally concentrated in M33 than the H1, and it occurs basically in regions of high density in the center, so where spiral structure can drive density variations that then bring the gas to a density where molecular gas can form, you find molecular gas.
Isn't that generic? That molecular gas is more highly concentrated than...
Yeah, absolutely it is. Yeah. And it does exactly the following... So let me just continue on before we go back to that. So then if you look at where star formation is occurring in this disk, star formation is not occurring over the entire disk. It's not occurring over the entire H1 disk. It's occurring where the molecular gas in the last figure is. Star formation is connected to molecular gas, not the total gas density, which is what the original Kennicott paper was based on. Okay.
What is that which modifying?
I'm sorry? Which?
The original Kennicott paper.
The plot that I showed you, the initial plot, was the total gas surface density Kennicott relationship, not the molecular gas.
Was that for, parts of galaxies or whole galaxies?
There were both on there. So I mentioned that the center points were for the center central regions. The starburst systems were up here, and the entire gas disks were down here. Okay.
And Brent, those sort of Galax results where there's also extended star formation
right
out, is that going to just be an addendum to this discussion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so we don't really know where that's coming from. So there are two issues. In some cases, beam smearing effects are playing a role. In some cases, it's resolved. And I know that people have looked in the exteriors with very high resolution U-band coverage, like with LBT, And they're finding clustered star formation where the local gas density is high. Mm-hmm. And so local molecular gas can form. So it isn't...
So what you're discussing will be generalizable to the atmosphere?
I think so, yeah, I think it will be. Yes.
Yeah, we find that DPH alpha images in very outer parts of galaxies. That was Annette Ferguson's thesis. You see, in fact, it's sort of extensions of the spiral arms going out.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Martin about this very interesting, why there are spiral arms out there. But you do see star formation, little H2 regions, quite far out.
And is it just that the CO sort of sensitivities, you just can't get out that far? You know, the levels of that.
Well, she's done some targeted stuff with the array on the Spanish one that was called Plateau de Bure. And they have found some small CO.
You have to know where to look.
Yeah, you have to know where to look.
Yeah, Leo is an expert, obviously, in this. So, let's continue on. So. So here now we have two versions of the Schmidt-Kennicott relationship. So if you look at the total gas in M33, and you just plot the star formation rate surface density versus the total gas, which is what the Kennicott-Schmidt relationship in the first figure I showed you is, you can see that in M33 it's considerably steeper, okay, than the 1.4 power. But if you look at the molecular gas in M33, you get a very different relationship. This is all from Mark Carey's work. You get something where the star formation rate is proportional to, you know, the 1.4 power, roughly, the H2. Okay. So if you just made an argument based on a dynamical timescale conversion of molecular gas into stars, that would give you something like this. But it's clear that there isn't necessarily the same connection between the total gas surface density in a galaxy and the star formation rate, that this is not a global relationship, because this...
Because it looks like the red line does an excellent job of fitting to the points.
The point is that the point is that the power is not 1.4.
Right, but just the fact that, you know, it seemingly is not causing the star formation, and yet the power law fits perfectly.
That's because there's a very good connection between the radial distribution of molecular gas and H1.
Then you would get the same. You would just get the power law dependence of molecular fraction.
If you look in their paper, there is a power law relationship between R and the molecular fraction in that galaxy.
That's not in general true.
Okay, but then that may vary how well this relate. I mean, there's some galaxies like M51 where there's almost no correlation between H1 and the total star formation rate. So I can show you that plot if you want to see it, but basically, the connection seems to be between molecular gas and star formation. And in regions where the gas density is high enough that the system is gas dominated or molecular dominated, then, you know, the same relationship basically holds.
So you can just interpret it in terms of that formula that you showed. If you have a power law dependence of FH2 on sigma gas,
right,
you will get the power law, but the difference.
This is an annuli.
Is that what?
That's right. That's an annuli.
That's why,
yes.
The points are correlated.
Yeah.
But I mean, isn't that just as interesting a question as why there's a power law relationship and why it holds the same galaxies and not others between these two forms of gas?
Well, that's the point of, that's the motivation for.
So I'm just reviewing the observations currently. So why do we care about this? Well, so one thing that we would like to understand, of course, is the galaxy luminosity function. And so this is just Blanton's galaxy luminosity function. If you just throw up Shepp-Twerman and normalize it so that at L star, basically, they match, then you can see that there's big gaps on this end and big gaps on this end, where we don't know how to populate properly the dark matter halos with galaxies. Yes?
Can I just say something about the physics that should be clear to everybody, but may not be, about the underlying physics? What you just talked about, and that is that stars, when they form, when you form stars, you tend to form solar mass stars. Right? That's the mode. It's one solar mass. And if stars form by means of a genes instability, which is what we think, and all the evidence points to, then to be able to get something that is going to condense out to form one solar mass at a temperature of 10 degrees, which is where, you know, all the star formation occurs, requires densities of 10 to the sixth per cubic centimeter. You only get those conditions in molecular clouds where you have molecules, and you never get them where there's just atomic gas.
It's too rarefied, yeah.
It's not just rarefied, it's also, you know, gas and shield and other things.
Sure. So I just wanted to mention briefly in the high mass end, the reason why people invoke things like AGN feedback or cooling is that once the gas finds its way to the center of the galaxy, the dynamical timescale of that gas will just eat it up right away. So you want to prevent the gas from cooling in the first place. Otherwise, it'll just form stars pretty much immediately. So that's why people invoke things related to cooling, preventing cooling, AGN feedback, or ways of preventing cooling in clusters. At the low mass end, things are a little bit less clear. So we know that obviously the number of dark matter halos are far more abundant than the number of low mass galaxies. You know, the way you can solve this is by making the galaxies fainter. If you just allow for cooling in those halos, cooling's fairly efficient. So you'll form a lot of cold gas at the center of these low mass galaxies. That gas will turn into stars on the star formation timescale. You'll form something that's fairly bright in a low mass halo. So you can allow for, say, supernova feedback to blow some of that gas out. But that tends to reduce the gas fraction in galaxies. So by the time you get to the lowest mass galaxies, you actually have too little in some models, too little, say, H1 gas in low mass galaxies in some semi-analytic models at, say, 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 9 solar masses in gas. It's too deficient at that scale relative to, say, the alfalfa survey results for low mass galaxies. So you need to keep low mass galaxies gas rich. I just showed you the lowest mass galaxies have very extended H1 disks associated with them, but you need to prevent that gas from forming stars. Okay. And so one possible key is that they're faint, they're very metal poor, and they're gas rich. You have to maintain all of those properties while preventing star formation. So that's an interesting thing. So another thing that is related to this is the character of galaxy morphology in a lambda CDM kind of cosmology. So we know that there's abundant merging. So here's a simulation from one of Andre's papers. Almost all galaxies, you know, undergo this kind of merging phenomenon. In hydrodynamical simulations that are cosmological, we have a large problem in forming good disk galaxies. Some people might argue with me. Chris has done a lot of work on this. And so one thing that that I highlighted, and also Chris highlighted in 2004 in a slightly different way, was that if you have gas-rich mergers, the residual angular momentum of the gas can form a fairly extended gaseous disk. So Josh Barnes worked on this in 2002 in merger simulations and found that there were very small gaseous disks that could form. What I showed was that if you can delay star formation or prevent star formation during the merger, then the residual angular momentum can actually produce a fairly extended gaseous disk. So if you have early mergers that are gas rich in low mass galaxies, we expect those low mass galaxies to be inefficient star formers. So if you're building galaxies through the mergers of a lot of little small galaxies, then if you can spin that gas up during the merger, that's how galaxies gain their angular momentum, by the way, through mergers, not through, well, you know, it's a different picture from this, from the tidal torquing picture. They give roughly the same answer, but in cosmological simulations, galaxies get their angular momentum through mergers. And so there's some reason to think there might be some connection between mergers and disks. Here's an observed galaxy at 2.4 with a Symphony telescope, or a Symphony instrument on the DLT. This is from Genzel et al. There's also more recent results, where they find a large, rapidly rotating disk galaxy at redshift 2.4. The claim was, well, this galaxy could not have formed out of a merger because the velocity field and the velocity dispersion field are too symmetrical. What we did is we showed that the previous galaxy I showed in the last figure that formed out of a merger actually looks a lot like this Z of 2.4 galaxy statistically. We did the same kind of analysis and we showed that you can actually form galaxies almost just like that galaxy in a gas-rich merger. This was published actually this week in AppJ Letters. So we would like to connect the dots. We want to make low-mass galaxies faint. We want to make them gas-rich. We want gas-rich mergers to help build galaxies, and we all believe lambda CDM. So we need to put these things together, and one way of putting it together is by using the physics of star formation in the interstellar medium to do something different than the standard kind of models to reduce star formation efficiency in low-mass galaxies.
So is the Milky Way the one area of that flood over there that agrees?
Yeah, well, star formation just happens to be most efficient near L star. That's, yeah.
Over there, so free normalization.
Yeah, no, that's right, but, right, you can normalize it, but eventually you'll run into the need, right?
All I mean is, if you made some theoretical model, you wouldn't necessarily predict normalization.
You wouldn't hit the Milky Way right on, you know?
Yeah, you might predict.
Oh, yeah, no, there's some, whatever I needed to do to get there is what I did.
So can I just ask a few simple questions? One, inefficiency here is the conversion of total gas
into stars. That's right, yes.
Right, so then there's the molecular gas, so just kind of getting at what Leo was saying before, and what we've been talking about the concentration of molecular gas. How do you distinguish, so low luminosity galaxies at that cyan end are also metal poor.
That's right.
So it's like a seed issue as well, you don't have as many coolants for...
Well, you don't have a lot of dust, and H2 catalyzes on dust grains.
Exactly.
And so that's something Andre hopefully will talk about if we can get to him.
Okay. All right, we'll shut up with him then.
Right. So we've implemented a model, and I don't really want to go through this, but we've implemented a model that now uses molecular gas instead of total gas as the sites of star formation. And we have some way of tracking how much molecular gas is in the galaxy. We use Cloudy to calculate in slabs of gas as a function of density, temperature, metallicity, and also a local interstellar radiation field, which turns out to be crucial in low-density environments, how much molecular gas is there. And then we just simply convert the molecular gas into stars with an efficiency of 2% on a free fall time scale, just like Krumholtz and Tan say that we should be doing. Okay, so that is the basis of the model. So this is just a figure.
Is it a little wrinkled in that you're tying it much more to metallicity than before?
So metallicity will come to play a role. Here we're assuming the gas dust ratio in the Milky Way. Andre is going to tell you about things where the metallicity varies. But it's true that in a given galaxy, the density effect seems to be the largest because the radial gradients in the metallicity aren't enormous.
What's the typical density with star formation down?
So it turns out to be about 30 per cc. Okay. Right. Which in most models it turns out to be 1 per cc in say the Governato papers, I think 1 per cc.
Well,
right. So regions in low mass galaxies that would normally in a standard model be available for star formation in this model don't have molecular gas because they're too rarefied, so they don't form stars.
So you're essentially taking the effects of molecular gas because you can't actually see the molecules forming by imposing this more stringent density criteria?
Well, basically what we do is we say there's a slab of gas that's of order our hydrodynamical resolution. We use Cloudy to tell us as a function of the density of that gas, the temperature, the metallicity, and the strength of the interstellar radiation field impinging upon it, how much molecular gas is there. That's what. So we don't try to
all that fancy stuff and just said we're only going to form stars at 30 instead of 1. Would you get the same thing?
Well, no. Actually, I don't think you. Well, I don't think you would. And so the reason is that there's metallicity effects that should be there that aren't included in this, but Andre will talk about them. And also, the interstellar radiation field plays some role in that. And so you don't know. So you can say that I'm going to mimic the physics by a threshold, and that's what everyone's been doing forever. It's just that they chose the threshold at a weird place. Now, that threshold will reflect the amount of molecular gas. It turns out that in low-density gas, without an interstellar radiation field, you get molecules at 1 per cc, just not a lot of them. And so star formation occurs in a different place depending on whether there's an interstellar radiation field or not.
You'll get a better approximation.
Okay. Oh, so I didn't even explain what's going on here. So this is a galaxy, and this is a map of the star formation rate surface density. This is a map of the H1 surface density. You notice in the center of the galaxy where the molecular where the density is high, there's no H1, and that's because above of about 20 solar masses per square parsec, galaxies don't have H1 anymore. They only have molecular gas, and this is where the molecular gas is. And you can see the molecular gas correlates well in the position where the star formation is occurring.
That can't actually be true.
What can't be true?
That you go exclusively to molecular, because you think at least in the
Leo, planet, do you want to?
Okay, yeah. Molecular clouds, you hit neutral.
You always have some atomic gas.
Okay.
The amount of atomic gas that you have relative to the molecular is very small. So, for example, one of the places where you see this most markedly is in early type galaxies. Whereas, formulate this, a lot of this stuff in terms of interstellar pressure. The pressure is enormous, and as the pressure is enormous in the center of any of these galaxies, what probably happens is that you don't have a diffuse interstellar medium anymore of atomic gas. This is something that has not been checked out, but for the atomic gas is on the skins of the molecular gas.
And
so and much of the interstellar medium is ionized.
That's, yeah. So I'm
just got a bar galaxy, but a non-bar galaxy.
It just changes where how much molecular gas you get. So it depends on the surface density and the pressure would be different.
The outer bars are morphologically similar.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's an interesting, Leo, what you just said is an interesting, Jennifer, what you just said is an interesting constraint on these models in terms of the interstellar radiation field. Because depending,
you need some ionization. So you need some UV radiation to keep the diffuse part. Right, so if you looked at the ionized fraction, for instance, in this model, you could compare it with, if you can make the measurement in a dense region, you could compare it and see if this made sense. But we're using Cloudy, and Cloudy has been verified under a lot of conditions to give an answer that, under some conditions, agrees well with observation.
But you always have an interstellar radiation field because you've always got the star formation.
Yeah.
Sure. No,
and
no,
it's the
that's not a doubt, but whether or not you're actually in this model getting the detailed physics right in terms of, are you actually getting fractions of ionized versus molecular versus...
So I don't think we're making detailed physical predictions with the abundance, right? We're using Cloudy to give us some idea of the way that it should happen. But I can't claim to you that it's 100% correct because there's approximations that you have to make. There's limited resolution, and there's some other things that we can talk about. But
right, no, it's certainly not.
The resolution in this is better than 30 parsecs.
Yep.
Okay. So we're using of order a million particles in some of these galaxies, in the galaxy.
You couldn't do this before.
Let me just say,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can't.
Dense
yeah.
Regions
that's right.
And outer regions, so
I think this stuff is a really good first step.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It is a really good first step, and in terms of getting all the details right. Probably they're not all right.
They're certainly not all right. The point is to have observations to constrain them and to identify the things that could possibly constrain them.
The place where you're most likely to do them is the place where the observations are missing now, and that's in the dwarf galaxies.
That's right. And this makes definite predictions about what happens in dwarfs. So, for instance, in this model, in this plot, what I'm showing here is I'm showing a galaxy with a 300 kilometer a second rotation curve. That actually has a very low gas fraction, about 8% of gas in the disk. Here I'm showing a galaxy that's comparable and analog to M33. So it should be similar to the observations that I showed you previously by Mark Heyer. And this is a galaxy that's like DD0154, which is a galaxy that is 99% gas as far as anyone can tell. Okay. And so what you're seeing is that, so here in a galaxy where the interstellar medium is quite dense, most of the gas is molecular. So the scaling here is close to the 1.5 power law, just the dynamical version, the conversion of that molecular gas into stars. But when you get to the outer regions, it's not all molecular anymore, because the pressure there is too low. And so the molecular fraction goes down, the star formation rate efficiency goes down. In M33, most of the galaxy is at fairly low densities, and so there is a radial gradient in the molecular abundance, and that's what causes the steepening of this power law-like relationship. Not every location in the disk is completely molecular, and so it's not all available for star formation. And by the time you get to a low-mass galaxy, it's considerably steeper, and that's because there's almost no molecules in this galaxy, right? So there's almost no star formation, and everything is very centrally concentrated because this power law is like 4. So, yeah.
Just asking, this is a little bit general, but does the model of the molecular cloud break down on a certain mass scale? But here you just have to, in a very small galaxy where you only have 10 to the 7 solar masses of gas or something.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do you have any sort of discreteness limit, or is it?
Yeah, you will. And in fact, so if you look at the galaxies, our resolution is better than a molecular cloud, but it's of order a molecular cloud. And so. So another problem is that fragmentation has to happen. And there are numerical problems with hydrocodes and fragmentation. And so you have to actually prevent that in this kind of model.
Yeah, I guess I'm also wondering, not just on the numerical side, but on the physical side, is it right to think of dwarf galaxies as being a single molecular cloud? Or is it the case that
I think local overdense regions can form individual molecular clouds in dwarfs. And plus there's there's turbulence, and there's still turbulence in dwarf galaxies. And so the turbulent spectrum will give you some density spectrum that is roughly roughly log normal for an isothermal gas that's supersonically turbulent. Okay, and so there will be some part of that PDF of densities that will be molecular in a dwarf galaxy, but it will not be just one big region. It will be individual regions within the dwarf.
Brian, can I
yes, I'm sorry.
Add something here, just to directly answer the question. One of the peculiar things about molecular clouds and the disks of Milky Way nearby galaxies is that they all have the same surface density. You understand why that's so? And that's about 100 solar masses per square parsec. But if you go into the centers of galaxies, some of the these things that he's simulating. Observationally, we see galaxies with central surface densities in the molecular gas of as much as 1,000 or 1,500 solar masses per square parsec. What that means is that your individual, the idea of individual molecular clouds with these properties has to break down,
okay,
because you've got more surface density over an area of a few hundred parsecs than you do over the 50 parsec band.
Yeah.
So the degree to which that changes things, it's unclear whether that's going to affect things on a global scale or on a I wouldn't call it a microphysics scale, but a medium physics scale, is still unclear.
The question that's at the back of my mind is on what scale do stars form naturally in an object that has 10 to the 7th?
One parsec.
Solar masses. Well, sorry, not individually, but I mean, do they form in...
You do get Pacius conformation in the small galaxies, right? So you can really see...
Right, because there is a threshold-like behavior for the molecular fraction. So once you get above the density where the transition happens, then locally you can form molecular gas fairly efficiently. Once it becomes self-shielded, there can be a lot of molecular gas, right? So the density variations in the disk matter.
This might be too complicated a question. That's a side question.
We can talk about it later, yeah. I think the PDF of densities in the disk will tell you basically where the molecular gas can form.
Brad.
I'm sorry. Can I just mention...
You can tell me what the cyan points are.
These are Kennicott's data.
Are they the same in the total gas?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
No.
I think I just used the molecular gas points in Kennicott's data here.
Okay.
Also averages over the entire galaxy.
That's right. And these, yeah, so that's what the red points are, averages over the entire disks. Okay. The blue points are annular measurements from the simulations. You can see that the molecular gas Kennicott law is the same in all of these galaxies. That makes sense. Okay.
But now, just a technical point here, you're saying you're doing annular averages.
That's correct, yeah.
But that's because you have some molecular content at all locations.
That's right, it's just, it can be extremely small.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah.
Observationally, you can't do that.
Well, sure, but...
You have to do it
on
a pixel-by-pixel basis because there is
a... Yeah, I've done pixel-by-pixel, and I get a similar answer, and so I don't worry about it. Now, I think there are some interesting questions there, but... we can talk about them later, but for the purposes of this talk, you get the right answer. So one thing that's interesting that you can do with this now, I mentioned that Bruce Elmgreen came up with this relationship between the molecular fraction, the pressure, and the interstellar radiation field emissivity. And basically what he showed was that as the pressure increases, the molecular fraction should increase. But as the interstellar radiation field gets stronger, then you reduce the amount of molecular gas because you're heating the gas, you're photodissociating some of the molecular gas. So what Leo and Tony Wong and Eric Ruzulowski have done is they've actually gone and made estimates of what the pressure in galaxies should be and then compared it with the molecular fraction. What they find is that there's a power law-like relationship. And so you might ask, well, why is this different than this power law? Well, there's some connection between the amount of interstellar radiation field strength and the stellar surface density or the star formation rate surface density. In our models, the interstellar radiation field strength scales like the star formation rate surface density. It's the young stars providing the UV heating. And so this is the relationship that you get with an interstellar radiation field. And the green line is not a fit to the data. It is from Blitz and Ruzulowski. So you can see that the simulations actually reproduce this power law-like relationship and the normalization quite well. And one thing that's interesting is if you turn off the interstellar radiation field, they no longer satisfy this constraint. And so they produce this red line without an interstellar radiation field. And what happens is at low densities, down here at low pressures, there's just too much molecular gas, because the interstellar radiation field is helping regulate the amount of molecular gas in the low pressure regions of the galaxy. So this both reproduces the Kennicott-Schmidt law and Leo's FH2 pressure relationship. And then I mentioned this composite Schmidt relationship. And you can see that here, basically, this quantity should be linearly related to the star formation rate. And in models where you have just the standard Schmidt-Kennicott relationship with treating all of the gas above some, above 1 per cc as molecular gas, you get that relationship because the scale height is fairly constant. The same thing happens if you use molecular gas. So this relationship holds pretty well. The scale lengths of the disks don't depend, they're isothermal, so there is flaring, but the regions that are forming stars are fairly constant because they're in a thinner molecular layer. Okay. Right, and so then one thing, I mentioned Rosemary wasn't here, but Rosemary came up with this idea in 86 that local regions in disks will form lots of molecular gas on a rate that depends on the angular frequency, because that's like the two-body interaction timescale in the disk. So locally, you'll enhance the gas surface density, and that will increase the total amount of molecular gas there. So our model is well connected with the work that she did in that sense. We have a slightly, so our models basically reproduce what's going on in the data. If you compare with what's in Kennicott's M51 paper, these look very similar to what's in Kennicott's paper. One thing that we noticed in our paper was that we wanted to understand where does the density dependence on omega come from, in omega come from. And we showed that just if you have an exponential disk in a cosmologically realistic dark matter halo, it just so happens that the mean density in the disk, or omega scales with the mean density in the disk like the half power. Okay, and we showed that for a couple of different reasons, or for a couple of different models. So that just says that this really just goes, well, you can think about this to some degree as going as just sigma gas to the 1.5. And that's why it works better for molecular gas than it does for the total gas, because it goes with the gas that's being consumed to the 1.5, not the total gas.
Do you get, in the densest parts of this, do you get the linear relation that people see for HCN?
So I would have to do the tracer with HCN, because the abundance of HCN is also density dependent, right? So that includes a different density dependence.
These regions are not resolved in the simulation. They're tracing the gas about 100,000 cc's.
It's also important to remember that HCN all has the same density, right? And so the free fall time scale for a patch of HCN in one part of the galaxy and a different patch will roughly be the same. And so that will also potentially change the dependence. If we just said the molecular gas is all converted on a single time scale, we wouldn't get 1.5, we'd get something that was linear. So anyway, this is all I had to say. This may have been the entire talk. I don't know how time went, but thanks for listening to my part of the conversation. I don't know if Andre wants to say anything, or do you? Okay, thanks. Yeah, of course.
There is some work which is now about to come out, and some which has come out, which is challenging the power law of 1.5 on the Kennicott law, saying that it's linear.
It's closer to linear, that's right, yeah. So you're thinking of the things results?
Especially the things, because that's a really nice piece of work. Now, so the question is, what happens to your simulations if the...
So let me first say that on a galaxy-by-galaxy basis, we seem to be very consistent with the things results. And so I talked to Briggs about this. In fact, we talked in Copenhagen about this. And in fact, they show that for dwarf galaxies, the Kennicott relationship steepens. And it steepens considerably. And in the way that we...
Steepens just for molecular gas?
No, it steepens for the total gas relationship as it should. Okay. Now, I asked Briggs why... So I don't understand this completely, but I asked Briggs why... I asked somebody... why the relationship looks to be shallower in the things data. And he said that it had to do with the estimation of the star formation rate surface density in the disk, and that the methods were giving a different answer than what Kennicott originally
found.
That's
my understanding.
Yeah. I don't know who to believe yet. Now you could say, we've assumed that the gas is converting to stars on a dynamical time scale. That may very well be wrong. Right? That could be wrong. It could be a single time scale, maybe. Now, there are observations that would seem to say, Crumholtz and Tan would seem to say that, no, in fact, it does scale dynamically. So we have to choose something. We're not predicting that part fundamentally, right? We just have to put it in some scale. So if we put in, so, you know, but I think the main results of this paper that are robust to the conclusions about the star formation rate density are that the molecular gas in the total gas will not be co-located necessarily. The molecular gas will be more centrally concentrated. That will steepen any relationship of the total gas relative to the molecular gas. It has to, just because there's no molecular gas. I mean, if you do the average in the right way. So, or in the way that would produce the. Okay, so, sorry, Andre, now has 15 minutes. Thank you.
So the motivation for what we were doing with Nigne and Costa Stasis is very similar. Essentially, you know, if you look at this equation for star formation rate dependence of molecular fraction, sigma gas, and scale height, it tells you that there are many situations where you can get very different dependencies between gas density and star formation density. And so far, in almost all cosmological simulations of galaxy formation, as well as analytical models of galaxy formation, this relation was assumed to be universal. So it wouldn't depend, say, working in all situations. So given that it could be different, it's worth exploring what consequences different relations could have on galaxy formation. And you can think several immediate consequences, for example, in dwarf galaxies, if relation between surface density of star formation and surface density of gas is indeed could be very steep, it immediately tells you that the outer regions could be very inefficient at forming star formation. So once you get to lower surface density, the star formation rate will fall very quickly. And so the gas can sit there for a long time without forming stars. And that may help to understand why mass-to-light ratios of the final dwarf galaxies are quite high as well. Once you get rid of that gas.
You still see the gas?
Yeah. So there's additional process. You know, there's additional question of where the gas goes in the end. But at the very least, you have to prevent the conversion of the gas into very efficient conversion of the gas into stars in the first place. And you know, there are different ways of doing it, like supernova feedback and so on. But star formation itself can be quite inefficient. And local examples of small dwarf galaxies all indicate that the star formation is inefficient. In many of these galaxies, you see the scale length of the gaseous disk to be 10, so in some extreme cases, like 30 times the scale length of the stellar disk, which means that the stars only forming in the very, very center, whereas most of the gaseous disk is just sitting there inert to star formation. So in order to do this, in order to explore the consequences for galaxy formation, we have to implement a model that can track the star-forming gas. And in general, you should think about that star-forming gas, although we treat star-forming gas and molecular gas as the same. So what we've done is we've implemented a model for formation of molecular hydrogen in a cosmological simulation. And instead of using just a cloudy table that tells you what the molecular fraction is at a particular gas density, temperature, and metallicity, the simulations actually follow the reaction rates, which form molecular hydrogen and destroy it. And in those reaction rates, there are several important components without going into details. And one of them is amount of the metallicity, which controls the amount of dust. And dust is very important both in forming the molecular hydrogen, because the molecular hydrogen primarily forms on dust grains, and also shielding it from UV radiation. So the model includes these rates and includes approximate radiative transfer locally using local Sobolev approximation. And the radiative transfer plays a role of modeling self-shielding of the gas. So molecular gas can self-shield itself, so by itself, just because you know you have optical depths to absorbing UV radiation. And there is also just geometric absorption by dust grains. So dust grains also help to self-shield. I won't go into detail, but essentially you can put this model on a cosmological simulation, and this is an example of what happens is that you have a gaseous disk, and the white contours show the regions of high molecular fraction, in this case about 10%. So you can see that they tend to trace the inner regions of the galaxy, and high density regions in the outskirts, which in this case are spiral arms. You can see that the star forming gas has a very different distribution from the total gas density. It's much forms a much thinner disk, and it traces regions of like spiral arms and so on, similar to what galaxies, real galaxies show. So
why, you know, so we don't see this without the molecular gas. So what is, you know, where's the atomic gas, you know, in the part that's underneath the white? Is it similar?
Where's the atomic gas?
We just says, you know, if we can see the atomic gas, but it, you know, it took away the white thing. So would the atomic gas also look, you know, pretty much like that over there?
Yeah, you would have spiral arms as well.
Sorry?
Okay. I should have plotted the molecular and the neutral gas earlier.
This is just...
And you see the same structures. It's just that in a region where all the gas becomes molecular, then the H1 goes away.
This is just to show that, you know, if you associate star-forming gas with molecular gas, then the star formation will trace the regions that you see in white here.
Andre, coming back to the dwarfs, because it's very interesting, we see a luminosity metallicity relationship. And you just say that if you go to metal poor systems, then the formation of molecular gas will be less efficient. Would you predict them to form, you know, for low metallicity systems, also smaller systems, less luminous? Is that what we see?
Yeah, you'll get something like this. I think it's actually, we wrote a paper a year ago about with the same cast of players, that it's actually very easy to have a luminosity-metallicity relation of the kind that you observe for real galaxies just with inefficient star formation. There are other ways of doing, you know, predicting the same relation, but inefficiency can give it to you. And I should say that there's basic physical reasons to expect that at low metallicities, the molecular gas is inefficient in forming, but it's also basic observational fact, because if you look at people estimating gas masses in these dwarf galaxies, they never add molecular gas, because molecular gas is nowhere to be found in them. I mean, the masses of molecular gas are very, very small. So the entire mass is in H1.
One thing we have to be careful about here is that when you, observationally, when you look for molecular gas, typically you're looking at CO. And the problem in dwarf galaxies is, because of all the things that Andre said, is that the UV radiation can penetrate much further. It penetrates much further in the CO than it does in the H2. So there's a lot of evidence that there's big H2 halos around the molecular clouds that are not traceable in the CO. So while it remains true that you tend to have less molecular gas, you can have much more than you think, because you don't have the CO to trace it.
I thought it was continued radiation that breaks up there.
No, it's radiation in the lines, because the opacity in the line is so very, very strong.
But how can I be honest, not the part that...
But you've got an H2, you've got these Lyman Mohr bands that are just so opaque and you know, they're close to the Lyman limit anyway. But I think this is a pretty well established from the quantum mechanics of the hydrogen molecule and CO as well. And it's just that what happens is that to be able to get the shielding, you have to go much further in to the CO, that you can dissociate a larger column of CO with it. In the same radiation field. So it's just a caveat.
But I also want to add that it's not just dwarf galaxies, it's also LSB galaxies. People have tried to search for molecular gas in low surface brightness galaxies, some of them are quite large. They're not dwarf. I mean, large fraction of LSBs are actually small galaxies, but there are some which are quite large. In fact, the largest in extent galaxies in the local universe are LSB galaxies. And in pretty much all of them, there are only upper limits, and these upper limits are of order of like 1% of gas as a molecular form. In some of the cases, there are detections, and I think they're like of order of a couple of percent. So, you know, there are environments that are low metallicity or low surface density that are very inefficient in forming molecular gas. And so if such environments could be prevalent, say, in any stage of evolution of a galaxy, you would not form star-forming gas, and you would be very inefficient at converting gas into stars.
So is this distinction between CO and and H1 tested, H2 tested anywhere by quasar, background quasars?
Not by background quasars, but it's pretty well established in the LMC and the SMC.
Actually, this is the plot I have here. So this is the this is one of the I won't show you any sort of in detail, but I just want to drive home that there is this dependency that will enter into this FH2 factor. So this factor will depend on the metallicity. The way it's the density dependence of FH2 here will change as with different metallicities. So what this shows is the molecular fraction as a function of three dimensional, so it's volume gas density. For three different metallicities. So this is the result of this calculation, this model. You see that there is a very sharp transition, so there is a H1 gas and then transition to molecular gas at a particular density, and it's very clear that this density changes as you change the metallicity. As you decrease the metallicity, for a gas at a given density becomes harder to form H2, both because there is less dust grains to form them on, and also because it's harder to self-shield. So there is a clear progression. And what Leo was saying, there is, if you now look at the column density, which is what observationally is measured, and you look at measurements within Milky Way disk, LMC, and SMC, which give you three different metallicities, you find a similar trend. So the transition, the column density at which you transition to molecular gas, scales roughly linearly with metallicity. So why is it important? Well, if you go to redshift 5, most galaxies would be in this regime. The metallicity could be quite low. You know, this is 0.1 solar, but it could be even lower, right? So it tells you that the star-forming regions were much concentrated to much higher densities of the gas. So in other words, there could be that a much smaller fraction of gas was eligible for star formation.
Was this qualitatively before?
Not that I know of.
Because people
Wait, what do you mean?
Strong arguments about what sort of stars can form, and then they just say, well, you get up to 10⁻⁴, something like that, and it totally changes, and that was the story.
There are no models of galaxy formation that I know of that explored consequences of star formation relation. Star formation depends on the gas density with metallicity. You know,
the IMF, but not so much.
The assumption is usually that you have a universal relation between gas density and star formation density, and it doesn't depend on metallicity or anything else.
So that's related to your question before, in the quasar absorption line, I mean, there's a lot of evidence now, that you're not seeing a molecular gas, that you're seeing low metallicities. I mean, so actually this discussion is going on in a parallel way in the, sort of what you would classically consider the IGM world. But
this trend actually would very naturally explain the fact that in Damplin and alpha systems you don't see much star formation. So
right,
because most of
this is in the discussion section of our paper actually that you mentioned this, and it's definitely the case. So
but actually the samples of Damplin and alpha systems that now have H2 and metallicity measurements. So people, it's very, very difficult to find molecular gas in the Damplin and alpha systems. And the Petitjean sample, and the old CO is only just detected in one or two very recently. So it's actually much more recent.
But the fact that the Monell plot peaks at something bigger than zero has more to do with them than just the overall presence of gas in galaxies, and obviously metallicity is working against
it. It's presence of gas and also the fact that you have probably lots of disturbances in the disk that can create high density regions. Accretion, interactions, and so on. So I'm done, we can discuss.
I'll come back up for the discussion, unless you want me to keep sitting, it's fine.
Well, let's just ask you about the sample analysis question again. So there are limits from for example, Chen and Wolf kind of limits and that kind of thing. And it's not, people haven't actually quantitatively tried to say whether or not, I don't know about this particular result, but people haven't actually, you know, they just know that it's not consistent with Kennicott-Schmidt, so it's obvious that the gap, the H1 isn't, you know, I mean, that's pretty clear. But quantitatively figuring out whether or not those column densities actually, you know, are consistent with the star formation rate.
So, I would just say that if you can measure the column of molecules, then there should be some relationship between
the
star formation.
Right, so that's the thing. So I have this tape, so I can show you guys this, you know, this table. So, I mean, there's only like 11 systems that have, you know, some many, many damp line analysis systems, but there's only like 11 that have molecules. You know, they do have column densities or limits on the column densities, very, very low. They're all high. Interestingly, of course, they have all high metallicities. So, you know, putting this, you know, kind of doing that comparison is.
Maybe so that everybody knows what we're talking about. There's a couple of results related to damp Lyman alpha system. One is that there is very little molecular gas in the line of sight in the spectra that people detect. So most of the gas absorbing, most of the gas that is associated with DLA is in H1 form. And there's a second result that that was Wolf and Chen paper a couple of years ago, and that's they looked at the column densities of associated with DLAs. And then I looked at very, very deep Hubble ultra deep field images, trying to detect the star formation signature associated with these. So we calculated what cross section of the sky should be at a particular column density, and then applied the Kennicott relation to predict the surface brightness in UV. And I found that it should be detectable. They looked hard, and the fraction of sky at this UV surface brightness should be quite high. So I looked at the deepest image we have, Hubble ultra deep field image, and they found none of that emission. And they put an upper limit on the star formation density at that column density, which is about 10 times lower than what Kennicott relation would predict. Their result, we discuss in the discussion with the paper with Brandt, can be very easily explained if you make the Kennicott relation steeper. Just not outrageously steeper, but you know, something like an M33. If most of the DLAs, for example, those stretches are like M33 today, you will get this result because the relation is much steeper than.
There is one thing one has to be careful about the first observation, you know, of the DLAs and having a small molecular content, is that it could be that the surface filling fraction of the molecular clouds is small.
This is right, exactly.
And there, that's something which can be answered. And the fact that when you're making radio observations, you're looking at a big area. Whereas you're looking at a pencil beam from the DLAs. So they're fundamentally different kinds of things. But that answer, and I don't know if it has already been answered, is that you get it with statistics.
Right, so that's the problem.
Once you get enough
DLAs. You don't have enough sight lines.
But,
or you have some, so that's actually something good.
Yeah, but I don't know how many DLAs there are at this point. Is somebody?
There's about 11 with. There's about 11 systems where they detected molecules, many, many without, but, you know, there's only, I mean, it's really very, very few.
Right, but then it gets.
So it's hard to break this degeneracy with the current statistics, but it's the obvious thing to do, yes.
Right, but this degeneracy would not be an issue for the second part, that
no,
the given column density.
That's right.
You know, there's no way around this argument. I thought for a while whether there's any way to explain their, you know, maybe because it's column density, but their statistical argument is very strong that, you know, the DLAs collectively sample a particular column density, and at that column density, local realities predict what star formation should be according to Kennicott's relation. And it's factor of 10 discrepant, at least, because they only have an upper limit.
can you do this at all by, I just wondered if you can do this at all by ratio?
With DLAs?
I mean, you can get the contribution along the lines of sight as a function of redshift. I'm just wondering if you could see this also changing with metallicity, so I presume it changes that over time.
And the UV background's also changing, right, that place. Now, the UV background locally is like 100 times less than the local interstellar radiation field in the Milky Way disk, 100 or 200 times. But it increases by a factor of 10 to redshift, too. So, in the outer regions where there's little star formation, the UV background at redshift 2 can play a larger role. And other people have commented on that and how that might affect the molecular abundance and star formation of lower mass galaxies. One thing I didn't mention, I thought I would plug, I wrote a conference proceeding for the Copenhagen conference about GRB host galaxies at redshift 1 to 2. And one interesting observation for those galaxies is the lack of detection of molecules along the line of sight to the GRBs in those galaxies. And some people have said, well, there's the outstanding question, are these systems just very low molecular abundance galaxies? Or is the GRB doing something to the line of sight to destroy the molecules? And so we used the standard kind of redshift scanlines for galaxies to predict.
Use the standard what?
Redshift relations for galaxy, like the virial radius, the spin, how this changes the scale length of the disk, and then simulated a low-mass GRB host galaxy and looked at the molecular content. And since they're fairly centrally concentrated, the molecular content is relatively high in that kind of galaxy. You can make an independent argument that the molecular content has to be fairly high because the star formation rates for those galaxies have been measured. So if you just take the star formation rate and the typical star formation timescale, it tells you that the molecular content is fairly large, a few tenths. And that's very, very much larger than the kinds of molecular content that you measure along the line of sight to those GRB host galaxies, or inside the GRB host galaxies. So that would argue that whatever is destroying the molecules or the lack of presence of molecules is due to something internally in the galaxy along the line of sight. So either the GRB is destroying something along the line of sight, people have argued against that, or the local star formation in the disk of those galaxies is somehow destroying H2, there's clustered star.
They argued against it based on what?
I'm sorry?
They argued against the GRB.
Based on simulation. So Jason Tumlinson, who will be here next week, I think has written a paper about this. Dan Whalen is another, maybe the same people. So that's just a point. Any other questions?
So does this then also, is there a whole AGM aspect to this that if you put in AGM feedback to get the model to make the right luminosity function and so on, that you're going to have a different spectrum, ionizing spectrum in the center of the galaxy, and it's going to change where all these thresholds are?
I've thought about that a little bit. I think that it is the case that the harder spectrum will do something different. But I have not. One way of testing that is just instead of inputting the stellar spectrum, the interstellar radiation field calculation, the cloudy code, just use an AGN spectrum and then look at the variance.
Because I thought this was sort of in the direction you were going.
No, this would happen very much closer to the AGN than along the line of sight cosmologically. Is that the difference?
No, I mean, I was just thinking if you're getting more clustered star formation zones, you're moving not much closer to a possible central source of the related spectrum.
So. That's true. And also for feeding models, so if you run simulations with supermassive black holes and then hydro simulations, the gas that gets accreted on the black hole presumably is colder. The stuff that makes it to the very center is presumably colder, whereas in the models that have been run, I've run many of the models, the interstellar medium in those galaxies has a very high sound speed, and so that actually plays into the accretion rate too, the sound speed usually. Yeah. So modeling molecular gas and mergers is something I definitely want to do but have not yet considered.
But so one reason why you want AGN feedback is you don't get, as you were saying, star formation happening in the center of red ellipticals later on in their lives.
That's a different thing than what I was just talking about.
No, yeah. Right. Yeah. So you're saying that you don't think the ionizing radiation from the AGN is going to be enough? Because I guess you don't see neutral gas either in those galaxies.
You do see some molecular gas at the center of some ellipticals.
20%. 20% of ellipticals and S0s.
So I'm not sure how effective the radiation from a typical massive black hole at the center of an elliptical would be at destroying H2, because the radiative efficiency of accretion onto those systems is very low. So most of the energy comes out in radio bubbles rather than through UV radiation.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, for this star formation, for the issue of getting at the physics of star formation, you know, after the quasars turned off in these dense regions, recombination time is very quick. And so, you know, you quickly get back to the state of the atomic gas going into the molecular thing. So you quickly revert back to this problem, I think, after the
So you think that...
It's just in the less, it's just in the lower density gas that, you know, all the X-ray photons and all that stuff is mattering. I think that, you know, I mean, certainly at the time...
Oh, yeah, the densities are extremely high. That's what, yeah. And so the time scales, so, I mean, that goes back to the argument that you want to prevent cooling. It isn't preventing star formation in ellipticals, it's preventing cooling. Supplying the fuel for stars.
So why are the 20% of ellipticals with molasses or gas on these stars?
They probably do.
I think that, yeah.
It's at low level.
So are the ellipticals that are like a rash, they have H alpha and whatever else in this one?
They do. This is stuff we're doing now, so I don't know very much more about the statistics.
Someone is...
You're okay.
Okay, we're okay. Okay, just...
Yeah. Can these models be used to predict or to show what star formation, like the first stars to form, how that process would look?
So the people who model that process do include, they include molecules, and they include many more reactions than, probably comparable to the cloudy models, I would guess. So people do that. These models probably aren't applicable to that because there are other processes that are going
exactly
on.
We don't there's no dust. There is right. No.
Yeah. There's no loss. So there's no metals.
That's what I was wondering. What's the difference then in the way
actually,
the stars?
So the model that was implemented here is exactly has all the physics that you need for the first star formation. But it's just a question becomes a question of resolution. So in order to the first stars probably form in very, very small halos at high redshifts, a redshift of about 50 or so. And so you need sort of to follow very, very small halo and all the process goes on into it. There is a number of very detailed calculations that were targeting those type of objects that were done. And these calculations are aimed at the larger galaxies, more typical galaxies that form at lower, later times.
And also, right, there's no... There's different, the radiation, there's not a bunch of other stars providing UV radiation, which means there's no AGN, but there is a cosmic microwave background, which would be hotter than.
I want to say, sort of, to conclude my part is that the message that I would try to stress is that the FH2 strongly depends on metallicity, and I think, you know, both the data and this type of model shows this. The dependence on UV flux is also there, but it's it turns out to be pretty secondary. So the dependence is not as strong. So you increase UV flux by a factor of 10, but you don't shift this transition very much. So the effect seems to be primarily the metallicity effect. So anywhere UV will change things around, and within the galaxy, it's very important in controlling the H1 reservoir. But in terms of redshift trends, the main trend I think is the metallicity.
So I have a question. So the way that the first star people end up claiming that the fact that they can't cool sufficiently is to make bigger stars. So here, going back to your statement that you make one solar mass stars based on the Jeans mass argument, I'm wondering about the trade-off here between making no stars and just making bigger stars.
You should realize that even in the first star, the arguments about what mass you exactly form continue. And
I know that.
And people have argued that the IMF may be metallicity dependent.
Yeah,
presumably it's
right. I'm sorry.
The two things when you have to keep in mind when you think about the genes collapse. One is the temperature, which is always going to go up in the early universe, for example. And it's one of the main reasons, and because of the strong dependence of the temperature going to the third, it's a very, very strong relationship. On the other hand, it goes the other way, the density. So if the star formation regions are, for some reason, preferentially denser, then you mount the typical mass down here. So until you have a handle on both of these things, you can't really know what the IMF is doing.
And turbulence plays a role too, presumably, because you have to worry about the relative sonic length and the relative to the Jeans length, and which is dominated. So.
Now, usually, do you get a change in the IMF from this?
So that's a smaller scale calculation that I have not tried.
I think you're not necessarily predicting different densities within the molecular region.
I mean, the molecular regions are not resolved themselves.
Yeah.
Macroscopically. So
I mean, you have to have turbulence to drive some.
power spectrum of density fluctuations, right?
Right, and that could, in principle, depend on where you are in the disk or something like that, so.
That's right, but I mean, people have looked into this, and basically, I mentioned this earlier, but the PDF of densities, the probability distribution function of densities, for an for an isothermal gas that is supersonically turbulent, is roughly log normal. And so then, you know, people have argued that you can convert that roughly into an IMF just from the density distribution of the molecular.
Do you run into sort of discreteness problems that you don't sample the high mass and
I think
necessarily
so,
enough per molecular cloud? I mean, that if you want to form
the
IMF, if you want to form, say, a 20 solar mass.
That's all you see, right? I mean, you only ever get a chance to look at the high mass.
There is several papers by Krupa and collaborators that have been arguing that the IMF that you get averaged over entire galaxy can be quite different than an IMF intrinsically in molecular clouds because of the sampling issue, because you convolve with the mass spectrum of molecular clouds. I think in terms of local dependence, in my mind, the strong indication that it doesn't depend on metallicity is the fact that IMF and globular clusters is saltpeter. You don't know exactly at the highest masses which are gone, but at least at the masses that are sampled, it's essentially consistent with saltpeter. So it tells you that it could be a very strong variation, even though metallicity is 100 times different, you know, you still get something very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
the thrust of some of what you're asking, James, is that the answer to it is really more sociological than scientific, which is that these guys are working on scale, on one scale. And most of the people who are dealing with the star formation, and there's not enough communication with the people who are talking about the formation of individual stars or clusters themselves. And there have been many attempts to do that, and to some degree, this is an attempt to do that as well.
I guess what I'm thinking is, if you imagine a big separation between the scales, you would think, okay, anything that's forming stars has, is sampling many molecular clouds. Any molecular cloud is sampling huge numbers of individual cores forming individual stars, and therefore there's no problem in going from a galaxy to a set of molecular, to a population of molecular clouds, to a population of, say, protoclusters or something, and each of those reproduces the IMF. Clearly, once you get down to dwarf galaxy scales, I mean, can you form 10 to the 4 solar masses on their own at all in any environment, or is there some threshold where you just couldn't form that few stars? So that's one question. And then also, as you form fewer and fewer stars, do you reach some point where you no longer have, any of the really massive stars, so you just don't have enough? Yeah.
So one thing that people have suggested is that the mean density of the density PDF shifts with the global surface density as well. And so if you have a lower surface density, as you do in a dwarf galaxy, the PDF simply does shift to lower overall densities, and so you will lose some normal massive clumps. So you will have, you won't have a 10 to the 6 maybe giant molecular cloud, or I don't know how many 10 to the 4, but it's definitely dependent on the total amount of gas.
Well, I think is Marla here? No. I mean, she would say that there is no lower limit because she's found a galaxy. I have an argument that it's a galaxy. With 300 solar luminosities.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of what I'm getting to is
350.
Does that make sense at a molecular level?
Well, you'd have to obviously. The idea is you mean more than that, and some of it is dot. Right. So all the in fact, it's iron, rich in iron and things like that, oxygen, calcium suggests that you didn't at one point in the vicinity have more massive stars than now dead. So currently it's 350, but...
I mean, maybe it's also a self-shielding question. Like, naively, I think you need some mass of molecular gas in each lump to shield it from, let's say, radiation field. And
smoke mass is cool.
Yeah.
So there's no limit to... If you can make things dense...
We know clouds in the Milky Way, where they're bathed in local interstellar radiation field, forming just a few solar masses, isolated objects.
Okay.
And people don't talk about them very much because they're not very important for the total budget of star formation in multi domain. But for this question, yes, they do.
So in principle, you will eventually find dwarf galaxies with three stars in them.
Yeah, maybe. There's another interesting aspect of this, which was discussed last week when we discussed Sigrid 1, is that the typical velocity dispersion in molecular cloud as a whole is several kilometers per second. And that's, if you have any sort of thermal instability, that's what you would get because that's temperatures of thousands of kelvins, thousands or 2,000 kelvins. And so the question is, would you be able, given that stars form in such environments, would you be ever able to form a system with 1 kilometer per second velocity dispersion? I think the answer is probably no, because the star forming regions are not that cold, and so if your potential is not able to support, if your potential has 1 kilometer per second certain velocity, and somehow you manage to form stars, you fly away.
Well, I was sort of wondering this about the question about initial conditions for these satellites also. What are the initial conditions? Is there any, can you make any star formation argument about what you should set up your stellar population to be like initially, at some early time when it first forms, dynamically?
Maybe we should just move the discussion to the, but thanks for
coming. Well, let's thank you guys for that. We will have a regular coffee for the rest of the